Welcome to Heart, a podcast about all things heart-related presented by the physicians of Advanced Cardiovascular Specialist. I'm your host, Carl Pendley. Our hope for Heart to Heart is to meet you where you are with valuable information from trusted experts in the field of cardiology. Today, we are honored and pleased to have Dr. Pavan Katakanini, an Advanced Cardiovascular Specialist located here in Shreveport, Louisiana. Dr. K, welcome once again. Glad to have you back for this podcast.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me again.
Topic of today is supplements, and this is something my knowledge of which is about an inch deep and miles wide, and none of which is very good information, I would imagine. We want to focus in on the good, the bad, and the indifferent as it relates to cardiovascular disease and good heart health.
I think the field is so vast, and there's so many supplements out there. I want to focus on a few things here in the next several minutes that we have decent data to support their use with potential benefit or possible benefit without causing harm. And the first one that comes to my mind is the most commonly heard thing is the omega-3 fatty acids. From a cardiovascular health point, we have decent data and evidence now that regular good consumption of diet rich in omega-3 fatty acids is beneficial for your cardiovascular health. How do you get these omega-3 fatty acids? You know, the most richest source is fish. And this is not any regular fish. I'm stressing this again. It's not every fish. It's fish rich in oils like salmon, herring, sardines, and tuna. And how much fish should you eat? Another good question. Two or more servings a week. How many of us do it? I don't think not as many as we should. But if you do this, you will get your adequate dose of omega-3 fatty acids just in your good diet, which should be around 1 to 3 grams per day.
Two servings a week.
Two servings of these fish will do the job. And then you do not need to pop up these pills that you need to buy and take them again. Now, there are some times when it's practically not possible and very difficult for us to sustain this kind of dietary lifestyle. And there are prescription omega-3 fatty acids that are available. Now, does everybody need a prescription omega-3 fatty acid? No. There are individuals who are at higher risk of atherosclerotic or cerebrovascular cardiovascular disease who have tried their lifestyle modifications, including this healthy diet, and still they don't have a favorable lipid profile who would benefit from prescription omega-3 fatty acids that they should talk to their doctors about.
Okay. What about CoQ10?
So there is a decent amount of evidence coming with a lot of studies related, clinical studies related to CoQ10. And overall, to sum it up, it is seemingly a good complementary addition to your already established medical therapy with a statin and other lipid-lowering agents to promote better lipid profile and better cardiovascular health. That's what the most available evidence looks like at this time. Now again, CoQ10 is there everywhere in all our cells, mostly in the most active organs of our body, like the heart, the liver, the kidneys, the brain. And by taking CoQ10, we are basically increasing the ability of these cells to produce energy better in a more efficient manner. So if somebody has a specific problem related to taking the most commonly used cholesterol-lowering drug like a statin, a lot of patients with cardiovascular disease are on a statin. Sometimes patients cannot tolerate a statin, and statins cause muscle pain, muscle spasm, and muscle symptoms. Studies have shown that, particularly in this group of patients, taking CoQ10 about 200 to 400 milligrams a day has been shown to decrease the incidence of this muscle symptoms in patients who are not able to tolerate statin, while giving them the benefit of a cardiovascular health point of view.
Yeah, and you're, and just to be clear, you're not saying CoQ10 instead of statin, it's in addition to.
Absolutely. And if you're unable to tolerate it, then of course, you know, that's a different story. But it helps with that. Then we have evidence coming through recently in the trials recently that CoQ10 is also of some benefit in patients with mild forms of congestive heart failure, where they have shown some improvement in symptoms and decreased adverse effects. But particularly with statin-associated problems, I think those kind of patients will probably benefit more from utilizing the CoQ10s. So that's where we are with evidence related to that.
Okay, moving along, we want to review as we go along, because we're covering a lot of territory here. Omega-3 fatty acids, that's good. Anything more we need to add to that?
Only that omega-3 fatty acids, you know, if you take it at a good amount of dose, by which I mean 2 to 4 grams per day is the recommended for most people, they typically lower your triglyceride level by close to 25 to 40% if you use it well. And they do contribute to improved cardiovascular benefits in several patients.
And then CoQ10, we've know that it's particularly effective for people who are on statin drugs and want to get rid of the muscle aches. Now we're come to something that is completely new wrinkle in my brain: red yeast rice.
So this is another most commonly utilized supplement with related to cardiovascular health around the world, and it is more and more adults in the United States are looking into utilizing this. So I thought I'll just look at what the evidence is and where we are now. So basically, you know, this is obtained by fermentation of rice by yeast. And what happens, like statins, the drugs that you use to decrease your bad cholesterol, red yeast rice has a substance called monacullins. And these act in a similar way like a statin at the cellular level to decrease the bad cholesterol. So what we know so far, mainly studies started coming from China and then around the world, and now we are waiting for large trials in the United States. The data that we have seems to suggest that overall, this is an effective lipid-lowering agent when utilized in addition to your existing therapies. And large trials are being awaited. So that's where we are. There is a caveat to this. Initially back in, I think, 2007 or 13, the FDA had a warning that they issued with utilizing any kind of, any brand of not properly vetted or quality controls in place for red yeast, because there is a contaminant or a byproduct called citrinin that can be present in poor quality red yeast rice that is being marketed on the shelves, which can damage your kidneys. So, and it can increase the risk of cancer. If you don't get a good quality product, then you can unknowingly harm your kidneys. So I would want to caution our listeners that while this is an increasingly popular supplement used by a lot of patients for promoting their favorable cholesterol profile, make sure that you do look in and research to see that you are getting a product which is free from contaminants and somebody can assure the quality.
How can you tell? I mean, anyone who's selling that stuff is going to tell you it's clean, it's good, it's not going to cause cancer, it's not going to make you die. Yes. But they'd be lying.
And I'm not here to promote any particular brand. More than 50% of patients are on some kind of supplement, particularly vitamins and minerals. Now, indiscreet consumption of vitamins and minerals is so common, even though we don't have evidence to support their use. That's what I would like to say. Not all of these are really helping you. You're spending a lot of money and effort trying to use this and hope that they are benefiting you. But unfortunately, we don't have strong evidence to support that. What evidence do we have? The one that you just said, some of the B vitamins, vitamin B complex and folic acid. They have been shown to reduce the risk of stroke, and particularly methylcobalamin and oxycobalamin. These are some drugs that have been shown to have some beneficial effects on cardiovascular health point. Now, what's the best way to get these vitamins? Obviously, it goes back to diet. And that's the natural way of getting the most balanced vitamin-rich food sources into your body. I don't think there is going to be a shortcut to it, which will show benefit across the board by popping pills in general. But the evidence that we have suggests that folic acid and B-complex seem to have some favorable data compared to the rest.
Where do we get that in foods?
Healthy diet, which involves low trans fat, high in fruit and vegetables, you know, the Mediterranean kind of a diet, plant-based diet, which are rich in vitamins. Broad strokes, that give you the most balanced things in there.
So if I have a piece of salmon with some nice veggies that are giving me the B complex, then I'm on the right track, right path, right?
Absolutely. And if you're consistent with it, and I think consistency is the key. A lot of patients do not focus on the duration, but they more focus more on the value of their normal lab work. What I mean by that is, I think it's important to have a longer duration of lower lipid levels than just have a low lipid level once in a while. So if you are consistent with your diet and habits, then you can accomplish that without having to take a whole bunch of additional supplements.
Vitamin D, very important. How important is it to cardiovascular health, and what's the best way to get it?
I think I'll go straight to where the data is and what evidence we have right now with vitamin D and cardiovascular health. We have some observational studies which showed that low levels of vitamin D in your blood, 25-hydroxy vitamin D, has suggested an elevated risk for cardiovascular disease. But when trials were done, we did not see that supplementation with vitamin D reduced your cardiovascular risk. Does it make sense? Low levels of vitamin D in patients showed that they have a higher incidence of cardiovascular disease. But when we tried to treat it with vitamin D supplements and did randomized controlled trials, we did not have convincing results to show that you improved their cardiovascular risk. So that's where we are when it comes to that.
So to get the levels raised, if you're not by pill, by just sunshine?
So obtaining vitamin D by natural sources, the sun exposure and your dietary intake is the best way to maintain adequate vitamin D levels in your blood. Now, depending on where we live, sometimes not everybody is fortunate like we are to get sunshine practically 365 days a year. And not everybody is able to get out during the daytime to get adequate exposure. So in those situations, obviously, you will rely more on diet, sources of vitamin D, and also supplementation. Now, when do you need supplementation? Or most likely, broad strokes, if your vitamin D levels are less than 20 nanograms per ml, as we all accept it across all multiple societies, then it's considered deficiency, less than 20. Between 20 to 30 is insufficient. 30 to 50 is ideal. And like with anything else, too much of anything is not a good thing. If your vitamin D level is more than 50, it's harmful. So if your vitamin D level is less than 20, then you should talk to your doctors and see if vitamin D supplementation is the right thing for you. And between 20 to 30, I would think changing your lifestyle, eating healthy, increasing your sunlight exposure could probably obviate the need for you to take any more pills. So if you have a balanced diet and you have a reasonable sun exposure, then just a dietary intake of 600 to 800 international units, as it's called, is generally enough. and you don't really need a whole bunch of, you know, concentrated, high dose, heavy duty vitamin D supplements to be on board for you every day. And beyond cardiovascular health, there is some data that vitamin D reduces mortality from cancer, but again, it does not reduce the incidence of cancer. So again, all these things need further study. And the same thing with COVID that you brought about. Can we cure COVID by popping vitamin D? No. Do we have evidence for that? No. It's everything, we have to put it under perspective.
Dr. K, with the vitamin D, you pointed out that too much of a good thing can be a very bad thing because it leads to deleterious circumstances and outcomes. Same goes true for calcium, I understand, because you got to have the right balance. You got to have it for strong bones. We heard that growing up, calcium being built with strong bones, so you got to have it. You got too little, too much. Where's the happy medium and how do you get it?
Yeah, I think it's extremely important. When it comes to calcium, what do we know so far? That if you take vitamin D along with calcium in those patients who have low bone density that have been diagnosed once they have the bone scan with their doctors, there is a modest reduction in their risk of having fractures. That's all we know so far about the data that we have. How much calcium? In general, if you have a decently balanced diet, you get about 1,000 milligrams daily by your just general food intake. And that should be good enough in for most situations. The other thing, misconception, is the blood level of calcium doesn't reflect your calcium status in your whole bone and tissue, okay? So if you start consuming a lot of calcium, more than 1,400 milligram per day, then we do have now evidence that there is an increased risk of calcium depositing in the arteries that supply blood to your heart, like the coronaries, increased risk of stroke, and increased risk of having a heart attack. So that is exactly right. Too much of that is not good for your cardiovascular health. So you want to make sure that you're not overloading.
And I understood from some source that the calcium can actually turn what are generally very flexible blood vessels into iron pipes so they don't move, and that results in bad things as well.
Yes, exactly. Our arteries are supposed to be smooth and elastic and compliant. And as we age, as the atherosclerotic process begins to take over, and when you have too much calcium floating around, it tends to deposit in places where it should not be. Calcium belongs in the bone to a certain level, and that's normal. But if it starts depositing in the smooth, elastic arteries, they become stiffer and are not able to relax that they're like they're supposed to, and your blood pressure starts going up, clots start forming, and a lot of downstream negative effects happen. So that's one of the reasons why too much of this should be avoided.
That brings us to a broad field of herbal medicines. I go into a drugstore and their supplement aisles are literally from A to Z on things that I can take, some of them herbal, some of them, the B supplements and everything else. What's your overall take on herbal medicines?
Yeah, I'm glad you said the overall take, because this field is so vast that it would be an entirely different dedicated podcast for that. But overall, patients should be aware that they always disclose what herbal medications that they are taking and share it with their healthcare providers, all the doctors that they see, because there is so many possible potential serious interactions between some of these medications that they take with the prescription medicines that they're supposed to be on, leading to unanticipated, unintended bad outcomes for them. So the evidence is kind of not strong for a lot of them. It's mixed for most of them. And there is some positive trend data for some of these. So you have to traverse this carefully. To sum it up, from a cardiovascular standpoint, what do I worry about when I see a lot of supplements listed in the medication list for my patient? I want to make sure that they are not on four of these medications. Too much of garlic, too much of ginkgo, too much of grape seeds, too much of green tea.
The 4 G's.
Exactly. And the reason why it is that while these are in moderation beneficial to a certain degree in some instances, for patients with cardiovascular disease, several of mine who are on blood thinners, like aspirin and clopidogrel and blood thinning medications like Coumadin, and the newer medications like, Eliquis and Pradaxa, Dabigatran, all these blood medications that thin your blood, the 4 G's that I just told you about can interact and increase their bleeding risk. So you want to always make sure that you are aware of the potential interactions with these medications.
Go over those again, if you will, please, because they went very quickly, but this is so vitally important. It's easy to understand what the 4G is, that is the mnemonic.
Garlic.
Ginkgo.
Grapeseed.
Green tea.
Yes.
Exceedingly popular green tea.
Exceedingly popular and probably beneficial in moderation. But when you take up too much of a good thing and make it too much, then it can be a problem. And that's why I wanted to share that piece of information, that if you are on blood thinners like antiplatelet medications and anticoagulant medications, and you have a higher bleeding risk, then you want to be cautious about too much utilization of this. And what do we know about the potential benefits of these? Garlic has been shown to have a mild effect on blood pressure and about 10% reduction in your LDL cholesterol. But overall in the studies has not been shown to have better clinical outcomes. You know, you have better biochemical data in the lab that you're seeing, but we haven't been able to prove it convincingly in a trial that this makes you live longer or have a better risk profile. There are things like flax seed, which are rich in alpha-linolenic acid, and these are some things that have been shown to decrease your LDL cholesterol by about 10 to 15%. So again, some patients may have gas GI complications and distress, but if you can tolerate it, have some evidence on that. Ginkgo, the leaf extract that I talked to you about, has been commonly used by a lot of patients for lung disease. Again, trials did not show any major benefit on this in coronary disease. Grape seed, again, has been used a lot, along with a lot of antioxidant compounds. No good clinical trials really that have been shown to have significant benefit. And in fact, too much consumption has been shown to cause many side effects. So caution with that. Green tea, which is so popular and so rich in flavonoids and vitamins, has been used as a possible treatment for improving mental alertness and also in weight loss sometimes. Observational studies have shown that green tea may reduce cardiovascular mortality and may make better outcomes. But the amount of consumption, you should have at least 3 cups a day to see that kind of benefit in these trials. And also not just once in a blue moon, but long-term use of maybe 3 cups of green tea a day has been shown in some observational studies to have some benefit. But rarely, people who have overused it and may have had some liver toxicity associated with it too. So caution with that.
Anything over 3 cups a day, you could be going into dangerous
territory. Yes, you may be overdoing it, yes. And the other one is hawthorn. You may have heard of it for high blood pressure and congestive heart failure. Some studies have shown that it improves some parameters in heart failure. While it is safe, it did not really show that patients live longer or anything like that. So patients have tried a whole lot of these things in their efforts and sometimes in desperation. I just want them to make informed choices so that they're not harmed by it.
As a general rule, it all comes down to ask your doctor.
You know, as a physician, you always enjoy conversations with well-informed patients who are already reading a lot about things and considering several options for improving their health, be it vitamins, minerals, medications, treatment options. At the end of the day, I think I cannot stress how important it is for you to take all this along and have the opportunity to discuss it with your doctor, no matter who that is. And lay it all out there so that both of you go over the things which are important for your specific health condition and help you make the best possible decision that is personalized for you. What is good in somebody else's experience in a different situation might not necessarily be the best option for you in your situation. This is what I see so often. Guidelines are just guidelines designed to help practitioners follow a certain pathway of care so that we don't harm patients. But we should sometimes think out of the box and tailor therapies which are better suited for your care. And these kind of decisions happen only when you actually sit down and discuss with your doctors and then talk about it, and not just rely on what's out there online or based on anecdotal experiences shared by one of your friends, however well-meaning they may be.
Excellent advice, a good place to end on. Dr. K, thanks so much for your time. To learn more about ACS and to schedule a consultation, visit acsdoctors.com or you can call 318-798-9400.